Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. For today, we are going to continue with our 250 years of U.S. innovation series, title of this latest edition, A Great Future in Plastics, which examines how credit cards evolve from a simple piece of plastic into a global payment system. I am joined today here in studio by Jeff Harwood, the lead contributor to this latest piece. Jeff is from the UBS Chief Investment Office, covers financials, the banks, asset managers, payments and processors. Jeff, it's great to have you with us. Thank you for dropping by.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Just to give our listeners a bit of context, Jeff, can you speak a bit to the history of the credit card, how this all materialized, the infrastructure put in place, and its overall impact to global commerce?
Yeah, sure. It's actually a really fascinating story because the launch of the general purpose credit card was actually not some well-thought-out idea or, like, you know, well-thought-out broad deployment. This was more of a novel experiment. So the credit cards kind of had existed with the diner's card, but that was only for restaurants and specific kind of companies. The general-purpose credit card was an idea from Bank of America where they just deployed 60,000 credit cards in 1958 in Fresno, California. And so people just woke up. They had credit cards in their mailbox. Didn't really know what it was, but Bank of America had worked in the background to create a network of merchants that would accept those credit cards. And so it became a general purpose credit card. However, Bank of America didn't have any underwriting standards. There was no application for the card. There were no credit checks. And so as people started to use these cards, loan losses started to pick up much higher than what Bank of America expected. So you think maybe they just shut it down. It wasn't a good idea. But they found that residents in Fresno actually really liked the idea of this general purpose credit card. So Bank of America tightened their underwriting standards, they got smarter with the product, and after a couple of years, it actually became profitable. And so the company decided to expand this idea into other markets, into other geographies. At the time, though, there were still rules limiting banks operating across state lines. So what Bank of America had to do was license out this Bank of America card idea to other banks in other states and other geographies. And so what they actually did was build up this network of acceptance, which eventually evolved into what we know today as Visa. And then at the same time as this was going on, like the 60s and 70s, another competing network was being built at the same time. That became MasterCard. And so over time, these two networks grew scale, bigger and bigger, more and more acceptance. And so what this actually meant from a macro standpoint is we were still in kind of this post-war economic expansion. And the development of this Visa and MasterCard network really helped to boost consumer spending. So it extended and helped grow that GDP expansion. And in addition to that, it also brought more activity into the formal economy. So there was less cash transactions, more card transactions. This led to actually incremental tax revenue as well.
It's a fascinating history. You think about issuing 60,000 credit cards without any due diligence. What could go wrong, right?
Right.
And it's interesting to hear about how some of these big companies are interconnected in some ways from the early days. If we fast forward a bit to the COVID-19 pandemic, coming out of that in the early 2020s, which of course severely impacted the flow of global commerce and how consumers shop, Jeff, how did the concept of the credit card evolve or adapt to a changing world?
Yeah, so when COVID first started, there was really a dip in spending because nobody really knew what was going to happen. Everyone was a little bit more cautious. And then as we got more comfortable, spending kind of spiked. And it really spiked in that e-commerce area because not as many people were going out. We weren't going to stores or restaurants as much. So e-commerce really, really spiked. But we didn't really think about that all that much at the time. And that really just highlighted the capabilities that the networks have built out over decades of acceptance, both domestically and globally. And it really just highlighted the ubiquity and the scale of these networks and the ease at which transactions could move from the in-person economy to e-commerce. Highlighted what Visa and MasterCard have enabled over decades of scale.
So, Jeff, if we look ahead, how might the payments business evolve from here? What might these credit card networks look like down the line?
Yeah, there's a lot of focus lately on stablecoin and really what kind of use cases there are there. Two that really make sense relate to cross-border transactions. So remittances, if you're sending money to family members over across borders, It's easier to use stablecoin potentially than it is to use traditional methods. Also, just managing foreign exchange. So on the commercial side, if companies are doing cross-border transactions, it might be easier, especially if they're focused in areas with higher FX volatility. Maybe stablecoins or other digital currencies might be more efficient than traditional fiat currency. And again, Visa and MasterCard are more of enablers in this space. They're already working in stablecoin, especially in some of those high volatility areas. So they're kind of a first mover, and the scale that they have is really just, it creates a wide moat, and it creates a better ability for them to enable some of these technologies. Beyond stablecoin and digital currencies, agentic commerce is also really interesting. And again, we saw recently Visa announced a partnership with an AI agentic commerce type company. And so we think, given just the scale and the capabilities the companies already have, we think they're going to be an enabler in that space as well as more agentic commerce tools and services are launched.
Well, it will be interesting to see how this all plays out, though. Jeff, thank you for dropping by to talk about the latest edition of the 250 Years of U.S. Innovation series from the UBS Chief Investment Office, again, focusing today on credit cards. Great catching up with you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan.
And just want to point out to you, our listeners, if you would like to learn more about this edition or read the others, as I mentioned today, we cover the seventh edition of the series leading up to the 250th birthday of the United States of America. Please be sure to locate the resources on the website ubs.com/celebrating-us-innovation. From UBS Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights, at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
Non-traditional asset classes are alternative investments that include hedge funds, private equity, private credit, real estate, and managed futures, collectively alternative investments. Interests of alternative investment funds are sold only to qualified investors and only by means of offering documents that include information about the risks, performance, and expenses of alternative investment funds, and which clients are urged to read carefully before subscribing and retain. An investment in an alternative investment fund is speculative and involves significant risks. This report is for educational purposes only, as UBS does not provide any investment recommendations on digital assets. Digital assets can exhibit significant price volatility, face liquidity challenges, encounter uncertain regulations, and may be susceptible to bugs and fraud. Investors therefore face the risk of a significant or total loss of capital. Risk tolerance is therefore an important consideration for such assets.
UBS Financial Services, Inc. does not provide legal or tax advice, and this does not constitute such advice. UBS strongly recommends that persons obtain appropriate independent legal, tax, and other professional advice.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.